Bong, I am back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Damian Lupo in the house, who's a seasoned entrepreneur who's launched and grown over 70 companies from zero to 100 million throughout a 25-year journey. So he brings a wealth of knowledge. We'll get into all about entrepreneurship. But first, Damian, we're in a little bit of uncertain macro times. So I'll leave it a little broad here for you. With interest rates coming down, inflation still kind of sticky. How would you describe just like kind of the overall conditions and where you think we're at today?
I'm going to go right into where we're at. We're in a completely different environment than we were a couple of weeks ago. Recording here a couple of weeks after the election, we've got certainty. We know where we're heading, and regardless of inflation, we've got boom times. I think we're looking at the roaring 20s over the next 2 to 4 years. And I think right now is the time to be in the game for anything. And it's the time to think really, really big, because macro is on your side, tailwinds are behind you. And when I look at my businesses and I look at other people's opportunities, the only question in terms of where people are going is and how big they're going to get is how big can you envision? Because you're going to have the perfect environment to go run with it, just about anything right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting you're putting it in those kind of perspectives, because I think we're in somewhat of an asset bubble, if that makes sense, where, you know, we're the lower class and everything like that is still feeling the effects of inflation, but we're having everything from the S&P 500 up 25% year over year, or year to date, excuse me. Real estate still up 8% year over year. And then, you know, we've got other things like Bitcoin just ripping and rolling and doing what it does. So, you know, with that, do you just see, I guess, with the previous economic policies of the last, the last administration that's on its way out here now, obviously with COVID and the massive amounts of money printing, from just a general business perspective, how do you see like the health of the general businesses around the U.S., because there's a lot of eyes that are on employment and other things like that. So are you worried at all about, you know, the potential of the small business and everything that's kind of coming with that and, you know, the rising costs of the capital expenditures?
What I'm concerned about is individuals that aren't adapting and aren't using new technology and then new ways of automation, with whether it's AI or robotics. I think a lot of people that are either working or running small businesses that aren't looking into the future and aren't grabbing these things are going to get run over. The eggs that I saw an article yesterday, and eggs were up 30% or some crazy thing this year. And so people that are in it. So what's happening is I see a lot of people saying, I want more money for my job, and business owners saying, hey, we're not making more money. You want more money. And at some point, business owners that are not adapting or basically using automation instead of people that want more money are going to either shut down, or they're going to strip people away and start using more AI tools. So the biggest danger is for individuals that are not adapting and are just wanting more and not wanting to do more. And doing more isn't just about spending more time. It's about how do you leverage these tools? Because I think that there's a huge opportunity for people that are going to go grow and create. So building businesses now it's great if you've got a million or 10 million or 100 million or whatever, and you can take that and throw it into Bitcoin or real estate. I think that there's going to be an incredible amount of asset growth and appreciation. And a lot of that, there's so much capital. I mean, what is Buffett holding? $300 billion waiting to go buy something. And so you're going to see assets, but for the average person that's listening, you got to get out of Averageville. You got to go build something. And when you build something, you're going to get tailwinds, but you got to think big enough. If you're thinking about how you're going to sell lemonade on the side of the street versus creating a lemonade empire, like that's the difference. And the people that are doing it on the side of the street are going to get automated out of existence.
Yeah. So with AI, I'll play a little devil's advocate here for you, because you know, the thing that worries me is a lot of the automation and AI and other tools that are available to people have a big initial cost, whether it's, you know, the automated registers, for example, at McDonald's. Like the mom and pop shops aren't exactly going to be able to automate those things without, you know, a hefty upfront cost. And they already have, you know, a lot of things that they're ordering, whether it's the burgers, the buns. They're not going to be able to order as much in bulk as, say, like McDonald's, right? McDonald's can order everything in bulk, get everything a lot cheaper, and automate a lot of those things. So it makes it difficult for more mom and pop. I mean, I know it's a restaurant, so it's a little bit different in a niche example. But, you know, do you think that is an advantage almost that the major corporations have over, you know, the small businesses? Or on the flip side of things, is it, you know, more advantageous for the small businesses because, you know, they don't have to go through all these loops and bounds in order to automate things, right? They can kind of flip themselves on the heads. They don't have boards that they got to answer to. And, you know, the longer, slower process to do that, they can just simply change the process at a snap of a finger. So what do you think is, I guess, better prepared to embrace the AI revolution here that's coming forward?
I think you have to do both. I think you have to be high tech, high touch. And that's for any business. And you can try it. Like I've had experiences recently where I'm trying to get a hold of a person, like a financial institution. And all I'm doing is I'm in phone trees and they've got great technology that bounces you all over the place and they can avoid the human cost. But I'm having a terrible experience. So I'm immediately thinking, where am I going to go and replace you? So what's going to happen? I think you're going to see a weaning of the experiences. People are going to say, I don't want to work with this company because their customer engagement, their user experience sucks. And so I'll give you an example of something we just did. We've got about 35, 40 employees in the organization, and we just switched over to the enterprise version of Zoom. And I was thinking it was going to be four times more expensive, but it's actually a lot more reasonable than I was expecting. And it's going to create a way better experience for internally and externally. And it's very high touch. And so that's a great way. And they have a ton of AI built into things. So you can do things faster and more seamless. So I think that there's some tools that people can use. My team's first reaction was, this is going to save me like 5 to 10 hours a week. That was one person saying that from just this one tool. And I thought, okay, the entire cost of this per month was worth just what one person's value is going to be. So you just have to ask yourself, what are we doing that's archaic? Because somebody is going to do it better. They're going to do it faster. They're going to create a better experience for the user. And if you sit idle, you're going to get run over. I mean, there's just no two ways around it.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this tech revolution that we're getting into is pretty, you know, I guess, adversarial for a lot of the, you know, businesses around the country and around the globe. But, you know, like outside of Zoom, you know, is there some specific, you know, AI tool that you guys are really honing in and focusing on? And are you potentially worried about, like, you know, the way that some of these AI tools are being built where, you know, maybe there's, you know, the dark shadowy coder in the background kind of like swaying everything and maybe having a little bit bias built into these AI tools. I know that's maybe more a little bit tinfoil hat-ish, but is there something that worries you about, you know, maybe this AI revolution going forward?
Well, the reality is your AI is getting built into everything. We've got it built into our software. It's being built into our manufacturing facility at Frametech, where we have a learning plant where the plant is actually getting smarter every day and doing more with less. So is there a concern? Yeah, there's always a concern that you can, and I don't think it's tinfoil, it's just reality. Like if you got coders, they can do things and you have to be conscious of that. So you have to like figure out who's protecting you from your coders. Like you have to almost have a white hat firm that comes in and checks out security. So I think that that's going to become one of those things that more and more people engage with, protecting their data and having to engage with firms. Just like normally you would just buy software and you'd do things. And now you're gonna have to think about how is that being protected? So, I mean, they're definitely not tinfoil. Like these things are happening. I think Elon is right. I think that this thing could go either direction. It could be a great relief for humanity, or it could be the end of humanity. So in the meantime, while we're still here and while World War III hasn't completely broken out, I think that it's important for us to say, okay, what tools could I use and should I use? There's a ton that we could use. I used to have a philosophy that if I could, I should. And what I realized is that philosophy meant I should all over myself. And it didn't really help me because I was doing a lot of things that were really out of alignment, but I didn't really understand what my core was. So when we all these tools that are out there, we see all over the place on social, it's not necessarily that you should do them. You just need to ask yourself, is this going to help my customer, my members, my community? Is this going to be better? Are they going to have a better experience instead of, oh, this is very shiny? A lot of the stuff is shiny, but really not important. The most important thing, quite frankly, is that people feel like they're cared about. And I think less and less that's happening. I think we've tried to automate things to a point where it's basically no cost to us, but then the person has this terrible experience and all it takes is for them to see some other opportunity for somebody that's going to care about them and they're going to leave.
Yeah, and I mean it is kind of like an interesting little game that we're going to be playing here, and the way that businesses are going to be built is essentially going to be flipped on its head, as you've been describing here, right? Where I think, you know, where as more of these tools get integrated and everything else, you know, things are going to become more efficient. I mean, part of the reason why Amazon has been able to blow up is, you know, simply that, you know, you can go on your phone right now, and if you're in a major metropolitan area, you can get whatever you want at your doorstep, you know, seemingly tonight, or you know, maybe comes in early in the morning. So, you know, the automation and all those things are going to be vital. Now, what are some industries that you think really are looking for something like this, or are needing something like this, where it needs to be flipped on its head and it's starting to come, and this is like a big industry that you think AI is going to totally revolutionize?
Well, one of the industries that I'm in is the construction and manufacturing space, especially construction. It hasn't really had any innovation to speak of since 1954 with a nail gun. So for 70 years, everybody's been doing the same thing. It's why we're also in a housing crisis now, where we've got probably 10 million missing units. And it's because people were just fat and happy and enjoying going along for the ride and making money. So you have to have somebody, and that's what FrameTech is all about. It's about disrupting with technology. But that it's same thing with education, those things in government, and with Elon and Vivek going in and saying, we're going to use our Department of Government Efficiency to slash and burn. You're going to have a better experience when you have the government getting off your neck. Because right now, I've experienced this, these three-letter agencies that are just basically crushing you with all of the regulations and red tape. There's a reason that when I look at business places to do business, to open factories, I look at places like California, and there's a lot of things about California I love, but I will not build a manufacturing plant there because they're going to put their foot on my neck, and it's just not fun. So where are we going? We're going to Texas, we're going to the Carolinas, we're going to Florida, we're going to Tennessee. And there's a reason that people are flooding into these places. So when you look at these places that aren't innovating, I mean, education, one of the proposals, which is amazing, is that we're going to create this America, the university, where everything is free and we have the best classes in the world. And meanwhile, everybody's getting buried. They have been the last 20, 30 years with student loans and an education that's less and less useful. It's mostly about becoming woke. And so I think that there's an incredible opportunity for some of these archaic systems that have protected themselves. And we're just saying, okay, inside of our construction company, how do we deliver something that's 10 times better? That's the question. How do you deliver? Look at anything out there and say, is there a way for me to do something 10 times better, have a 10 times better experience, 10 times better quality? Because if your stuff is 10% better, nobody's going to change. But if it's 10 times better, they're going to run to you. And so you have to think about that and get around people that are thinking like that. That's what we do with FrameTech and the other companies. It's about the experience of just interacting with people that's 10 times better versus, oh, great, I got another app. Like, nobody gives a crap. You got another app. Whoop-de-doo. It's a shiny app. But am I going to do anything and really engage, or am I going to get excited because they really care about me? And the human element is so lacking and falling apart anymore with all of the high tech and the robots and you know, just the stuff. We don't even know if it's real. I think that's the huge opportunity. People want to know that they're cared about, and then they'll do almost anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think that's kind of why the whole like influencer type of marketing has, you know, essentially just like shot through the roof, because people are looking for more of that human connection, right? They want to feel like they get to know the person. So like, if this person is like, hey, I'm helping sell this, I wouldn't do it, you know, unless I really believed in it. That's why it's kind of moving forward. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. That's a clear example that we've seen as to people really wanting that human element. But that almost is on the opposite side of the AI revolution then. So what do you think? It's just like the AI revolution is just for, I guess, maybe some more of the remedial tasks that, you know, maybe the number entering, data entry, like some small task like that, opposed to, you know, the full-fledged like automation where, like, you know, customer service and all these other aspects of a business will be more of like the human interaction.
I think that's likely. I mean, there's years ago, I had a guy that was transcribing podcast interviews and he's in Africa, and I forget what we paid. He was like $3 an hour, and now that's free with Otter or Reed or Zoom or all the AI. And so he just like got AI'd out of existence. And so you have to ask yourself, what are you doing that is not going to be AI'd out of existence and will do better? I mean, accounting and legal and rudimentary, archaic, administrative type of stuff, things that are robotic that are over and over again, now that stuff's going away. I mean, it's just AI is going to do it better. I'm amazed at what you can do. You take a bunch of thoughts. You just like, I've written like 12 books, and it was painful trying to get my brain to process how this thing flowed. I recently took, I don't know, 15 pages of notes, literally dumped into the ChatGPT and said, what does this mean? And it literally came back and gave me this cohesive three-page paper. And I thought, holy crap, that would have taken me a week. And it took about 15 seconds for it to combine all that stuff. So I think it's important to challenge those things. What are those things that are really valuable as a human being? And then leverage technology to help you do those things even better and be more valuable. I think people are going to try to fight and hold on probably too long, and they're going to get wiped out. And the influencers that space, people can be really, they can have all their cool choreographed content. But what I care about is, does somebody actually have any intelligence because they've done something, or are they just babbling about something they learned on some weekend course? And that's what I see mostly in the influencer space. I see a lot of people that don't have any experience or wisdom. I think they have a lot of information, and it's fun, but it's mostly entertainment. And what I'm looking for is wisdom and people that are bald or gray or have experience through cycles and understand things because they've been through it.
Yeah, and it's difficult. It's a difficult game with that too, because the influencer space and kind of like where that's at, right? I mean, it really depends. Like, there's generally speaking a younger demographic when it comes to social media. So, the big ones that you'll see are mostly targeted towards the younger folk who, maybe aren't looking for the old gray-headed guy to tell you, what they're looking to do. They're looking for more of the boomer bust kind of things, which, might not actually be healthy for society. That's another rabbit hole we could get down later. But, I'm really interested in more of, how you see, business evolving. Do you think that the way that businesses are run or even have been, taught out of textbooks now for that were written, 20, 30 years ago, do you think that's even going to be applicable here in the next, 5 to 10 years, and everything is going to be essentially just changed dramatically? Because, the way I see things going, I mean, maybe we can get into this a little bit later, but I've seen, a lot of companies pop up from 2010 to 2020 that looked at the Amazon model, for example, where just get off zero, just keep trying to make money. Don't worry about actually making a profit. Just keep showing that you're making consistent revenue. And then eventually you'll find a way to make a profit, which is what they did with AWS. Like, Uber's a great example for, it popped up 2009. It's never actually made a profit. It's the hope is that it'll eventually make a profit once driving becomes fully automated and it's full venture capital. Anyway, this is a long-winded question to set up. Do you think that that's going to be the way of the future still? Or with, the current environment, high interest rates, do you think actually making a profit is going to be more of a stress of businesses going forward?
I think actually making a profit is the key and should be the focus. I think there's always going to be, when you have lots of capital sloshing around and you have a lot of venture capital groups that are saying, okay, we just need to get 1 out of 10, and that'll make up for the other 9 that fall apart, and we can wait and see, watch this thing losing money forever. I think that there's room for both of those things, but the danger is going, okay, I'm going to do a WhatsApp. I'm going to have 26 people and I'm going to have $26 billion come into my account and I'm going to sell it to Facebook. That's been a lot of people's philosophy, or the Amazon or the Uber model. And can it work? Yeah. But, and you basically just shoot, and you're shooting from the hip in the dark and hoping that it'll all, because of the network effect. And that's all these different organizations that are creating these multi-billion dollar things that we've seen that have lost money. They're literally relying on the network effect. And I'll give you an example of something where we are not relying on the network effect, and it's about creating some value that actually is profitable. The manufacturing firm Frametech that's disrupting the construction industry and solving the housing crisis is right at just under $1 billion in value, and it's 2.5 years old. It was scratch. And we're profitable. This is our first year of actually producing. We just started producing, and you can see our model, and that's actually, we're not waiting to have 75 plants so that we can actually be profitable, and then we go IPO. So I think if you go into something and you say, okay, how can we be profitable within a year or two? It doesn't mean that you shouldn't give yourself periods of ramp up, but this idea that you keep just like the public markets are going to just give you unlimited amounts of money is kind of a psychotic approach to a unicorn. And I think we've gotten used to it because we've seen all the stories and we think that that's normal. But that is not normal. It's not healthy, and it's not very rational in terms of creating wealth. It's just something that we're going to continue to see, because when you have these VCs that have so much money, they're going to keep throwing that money at things that they think they can do 100x or 1000x, because some of them are, and that's how they're built. But if you have that philosophy and you're going to go out and build your business in your town or your state or your country, and that's your overriding philosophy, I think I think you can use the network effect and find ways to create value with the network effect without saying, okay, I'm just going to lose money until I have a hockey stick moment where we go vertical and it goes from, you know, losing millions of dollars to we're worth $14 billion. Like that's what we've seen. And it's not rational. But people see a few examples and they go, oh, I'm going to do that. And then we're going to have lots of cool tech and lots of ping pong tables and free kombucha kegs and all this other crap that people got used to. And there's a different way of doing it where you're kind of merging. You're merging the new and the old, but the reality is there's never a downside to creating a profitable company. And that's the question is, does the market care about what you think is valuable? And if it does, then you can you scale it? And I'm not saying that everything has to scale, but I think that we tend to miss out on our potential because we're thinking too small. And like I said in the beginning, 2025 and 2026 at least are going to create an entirely huge opportunity for people to launch rockets, not just Elon, but business rockets, because this environment we're going to have tailwinds. We're going to have a lot of freed up capital and we're going to have a lot of reduced government. And I think that's a really good thing. But the question is, can you get out of your own way? And that's usually the people's biggest problem.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. And you know, it is kind of interesting. But do you think that we've gotten into this, I guess, maybe the mindset, or we've seen, you know, a lot of these unicorns take off? Do you think that's more because and can be attributed to basically like the interest rate environment that we were in from 2010 to 2020-ish time before, when it was basically zero? We had one little bump in 2019. But now that interest rates are a little higher, these dumb ideas are going to cost a little bit more. So there's going to be more vetting and less of them kind of seeping through the cracks.
Yeah, you're definitely going to see more. I mean, when money's free, when you can just get it and it doesn't cost you anything to be wrong, you're going to see some cool stuff, but you're going to see a lot of things that die, but nobody really cares because the money's free. And when interest rates are where they are, you don't have the ability to just say, okay, well, we'll just give this thing a try because there's actually a hard cost. And debt is hungry. Debt doesn't just, like, other than Michael Saylor with MicroStrategy, they have zero interest rate convertible bonds. And that's a very powerful strategy. Now, does anybody else have that strategy? Not right now. There's some companies that are playing with a model that's similar with Solana crypto, but it's very unusual. It's just because people see MicroStrategy as being this high upside, this asymmetric upside. And it's companies that are like Allianz is an insurance company and they want to invest, but they can't necessarily invest in something that's not a bond. So they have the ability to invest in a bond, but then they're getting exposure to crypto because they can't invest in Bitcoin. So there's this whole way of people navigating through this space and it's evolving rapidly. That's new. We've never seen that happen before. I just found out about that a few days ago, that this is what's going on. So you're going to see, because we're in an environment where we have 4 or 5% interest rates. And so Michael Saylor is getting 0%, but why? Because a company, the people with that money, and like Allianz put $750 million out of a $3 billion float, they put it into MicroStrategy bonds because they saw that as being a very smart way to have a mid-range to long-term upside. So I think we're going to see more of that, but I don't think you're going to see the same stuff we saw in 2015 at 0%. Even though rates may drop down a little bit, I don't think we're going to see zero or negative rates or 1% rates again, maybe not in the next decade.
Yeah, honestly, I kind of hope we don't, because I think it is a little healthy to have a little bit more cost of capital, because, you know, that's why we're part of the reason why we're in the place that we're in right now. But it's interesting you brought up Michael Saylor and what he's doing, because there is a few companies on a smaller scale that are doing what he's doing. But, you know, I guess as a business owner, are you looking at potentially putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet, or, you know, analyzing it in that sense? Because, you know, putting bonds or the S&P 500 index and all these other kind of things, it just simply doesn't keep up with inflation anymore. And, you know, the only thing that's guaranteed is that if you're holding cash balance, it's, you know, with the way inflation's going, is you're going to lose purchasing power. So are you looking and considering to doing anything like that? Maybe copying the Michael Saylor strategy going forward?
I honestly think that companies that ignore that or don't do it are going to get crushed. I think that to keep up, bonds aren't going to work, cash doesn't work. It's a lazy balance sheet. And the problem is the printing is not going to stop. are in governments worldwide are going to keep doing it. There's even though there's a collection of hard assets with the gold being collected by central banks, whether it's China or Euro or Japan or whatever the BRICS, your Bitcoin is the only thing that can't be just create. You can't create more of it. As gold goes up, you can go create more. That's what happens. If things get more expensive, then humans have this ingenuity. We go and we say, okay, we're going to find new ways to mine more stuff. But you can't do that with Bitcoin. There's only a certain amount. And there's only like a 1.2 more million more Bitcoin that can even be mined. And the last million is going to take about 100 years. So we're at a point where there's a pretty fixed supply. It's the hardest of assets that are out there. And so to your question about a treasury asset, yes, I think it's an appropriate move by any company that wants to survive the next 10 years.
That's interesting. Well, because I think that has been kind of my theory and one of my base cases for Bitcoin here going forward is that more and more, you know, nation states and businesses are going to start to do that. And, you know, I agree with you. I think, you know, with the amount of inflation that we have coming forward and, you know, the potential of more money printing, I mean, you know, we printed 40% of the money supply from 2020 to 2022. And so if we do that again, you know, that 40% is, you know, exponentially greater than what it was in 2020, which would mean inflation is just going to keep going more. So the volatility of these swings from business owners and everything else is going to be a lot worse than the potential, you know, volatility that you could be holding with Bitcoin. And, you know, with all that, is that kind of what you're almost like you're predicting here, where, you know, you think that, you know, with the interest rate environment that we're at and, you know, inflation still kind of, you know, shaky and not under wraps. I mean, I don't know if you use this website before, but I really like it. So I recommend it. It's called govflation.com and I'll put it all in the show notes, but it shows how we calculated CPI based on the 1982 calculation before they changed it, I think in 87. And in August, it had inflation still over 10%. So obviously, even though it was reported at 2.5, obviously, you know, inflation for everybody that's on the ground still feels it, but the government is reporting that it's not there, right? And you know, all these other macro factors are you know, seeming kind of shaky. So do you see, I guess, the only way out of it is essentially to print more money and then we get into this, I guess, debt spiral of sorts, and where we'll just have to keep printing more money in order to finance the debt going forward?
I think that there's going to be printing. It's like the government's only way out. Although I do like what Anthony Pompliano and Jason Lowry talk about. Jason Lowry wrote Soft Wars, and Pomp talks about stuff on CNBC and on his show all the time. That one strategy would be that the U.S. government goes and buys $250 billion of Bitcoin and then lets that be part of this strategic reserve asset, which I think is probably coming between Trump and Kennedy coming in and having a philosophy. They're very on the side of crypto. But that's a way for the U.S., in addition to cutting a lot of this fat and bloat that's just part of this big swamp, it's thinking about things in a different way. And other than that, we're toast. The dollar goes and dies. The reason the dollar hasn't died is because there's nothing that's better than the dollar. It's like the least ugly girl at the dance. Like it's a strange way of looking at it, but all these currencies that used to be money, they're now all just fiat. They're all fake. You can just print them. You can't print Bitcoin. It requires energy. There requires zero energy to print a trillion extra dollars or euros or yen or whatever. And that's, so I think that there's some opportunities here. I was very not optimistic a month ago. And after this election, I'm very optimistic because of some different philosophies that are not the course. You know, par for the course was we're going to print more money, we're going to spend more money, we're going to go to more wars. And that doesn't help anything. If that was the case, you just go build a bunch of bombs, blow it up in the backyard, and that's the U.S., the economy would be great. But that's, you know, we're shifting gears and we're saying, okay, peace and prosperity is a good idea. And the idea of crypto is that's the next evolution of global like superpowers. Who controls the Bitcoin? And people aren't really, there's some people that aren't getting on board with that. Guys like Bukele and Milei in El Salvador and Argentina, these guys are very forward thinking. And the reason that they're scaring the crap out of the World Bank and a lot of countries is because they're doing the right thing. And they're not allowing the World Bank and the IMF to control them anymore. And people have to be thinking about that in terms of their own local economy and their balance sheets, the companies. Are we going to subject ourselves to just whatever the Federal Reserve wants to do? And all these dollars that we're putting on our balance sheets, are we going to make those worth less and less and less and zero? Or are we going to be smart? Because with one of the things that people get concerned about with Bitcoin, for example, they say, well, it's volatile. Over 4 years, it's really not. Question is, are you trying to do this because you're worried about what's going to happen in the next 3 months or the next 3 years? And if it's your cash you need in 3 months, it's probably a bad idea. But if you're thinking about over the next year, two, three, I think this is incredibly smart, and people are going to be well rewarded that are thinking about things in terms of scarce real resources. And Bitcoin is just a transfer of energy. People say, well, what is it? It doesn't have any value. And I'm like, actually, dollars don't have any value. It's just a collective delusion that's forced upon us by government, by a government monopoly on force. Like, we're literally told you have to use these things. So it's thinking into the future, kind of like we're talking about with AI and robots and how we leverage that. Bitcoin is a way to leverage so you don't get destroyed by the money leviathan that's really been going on for the last 250 years based on the Rothschilds and their global domination. Bitcoin democratizes things and puts the power back in the people's hands.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wasn't expecting to get down this the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but I agree with you 1,000% on everything that you're saying there. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you say like a lot of people view that Bitcoin's very volatile. I would argue that the dollar is the volatility or the volatile aspect of Bitcoin, because you're looking at it in the exchange rate of there. Like, we know how much Bitcoin is going to get mined every single day or every single block, you know, every 10 minutes or so. The thing that's volatile is just if you go to usdebtclock.org and you see that number over $36 trillion and continuing to tick up. I mean, you sit on that website long enough, you'll get nauseous watching those numbers rise up. But, you know, with that, it's, you know, $106,000 plus per person in the U.S., per U.S. citizen worth of debt. And it's $272,000 plus per U.S. taxpayer. And that's just going to keep going up. And so, you know, the average salary in the U.S. is under $60,000, but say $60,000 for ease of numbers here. It'll take you 4.5 years to basically pay off the amount of debt that you have for each taxpayer if you're paying your entire salary. And if you pay, you know, half your entire salary, then it'll take you 10 years, assuming that number doesn't go up. But, you know, if you go to that website, that number is going to be $272,000 today. And in a month, it's probably going to be 73, 74, 75. Who knows? It's just going to keep going up. So, you know, are you confident, I guess, with everything that you've seen Trump line up do with the Department of Government Efficiency, all these other things, that they're going to maybe halt this number from going up so drastically and maybe stop us from a debt spiral? Are you optimistic on these next 4 years?
I'm more optimistic than I've ever been in my life, other than when I was 20 and I thought I could fly. And then I took up skydiving and almost died 4 times. So, like, I'm very optimistic about where we're going. In fact, after the election, I felt like there was this weight that was lifted to actually go and thrive and do the things and create. And here's the thing that everybody literally has to embrace. You have to get ahead of the thing that is stealing from you. And what's stealing from you is the destruction of whatever you have, meaning your purchasing power. And if you don't get ahead of that, so if you're losing 10 to 15% a year, which you are, that's what everybody's doing. I mean, it's minimum. It's not 3 or 4 or 5%. That's all BS, as you well know from the stats you're talking about. You've got to think about how am I creating more, and how am I doing 30 or 40% growth? Well, how are you doing that? You're going to go ask your employer for a 30% bump, and you're not going to have a job. You're going to get outsourced. Something's going to happen, or you're going to get automated. So the question is, you have to go find a way to create more value. And when I look at my employees and they want more money, I'm like, show me how you're going to create more value, and I will give you part of that. That's how this works. You don't just get to ask more and take more. This is not the U.S. government where you get to work less and get more. Like, just because you've shown up, just because you've been here another year doesn't mean you're worth more. You need to deliver more. And we all have so much more potential in our companies and individually than we tap into. I think, unfortunately, Americans in general have gotten very lazy. And we have this entitlement mentality that's been baked into us by a lot of dumbasses that are teaching that that's the way and the truth and the light. And I'm like, you guys, this is how you destroy society. But there are other people that are saying, okay, we're going to do more and create more. Guys like Elon. And I have a lot of respect for the creators and the builders. And I think there is a shift where a lot of young people are saying, I, you know, entrepreneurs, entrepreneurship, that's cool. Like I want to go build something. And so I see that there's this like fire and flare that's going on and the crypto community that's building decentralized things. And they're saying, we don't want any centralized control, whether it's bankers or governments. We want to have people controlling and have decentralized, you know, DEXs. And like, that's really cool. Disrupt the banking system. Like I'm very optimistic about the philosophy of how people are starting to wake up about the, you know, and realizing that systems like banking and finance and the government are incredibly corrupt. They're incredibly centralized and they've been used against us. And there's a cool thing. And thank God Elon bought X. So we can actually have these conversations and we're not shut down and told that, no, you're a crazy person and you have a tinfoil hat. Now, the reality is conspiracy theorists that's been the winning team. The ones that, you know, everybody else that's gaslighting, those guys are losing because the truth is coming out.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think that the entrepreneurial spirit is getting sort of a revitalization here in the US, to say the very least. So, you know, with that, right, I mean, you've been very successful in building businesses. What advice do you have people outside of just automating, you know, starting from zero here, growing a business in this, you know, kind of, I guess, economy that's a little uncertain, but there is a lot of optimism here going forward. You know, if somebody was, I guess, taking the leap, going to start a business now, what would something that you would tell yourself back when you were starting, but say you're starting here today, what would be some advice that you would give some people moving forward?
The biggest advice is you have to disconnect from caring what other people think other than your customers. Your customers, that's you got to care what the customer thinks, because if the customer doesn't like your thing or what you're doing, then you don't have a business. But everybody else, your friends, your family, your wife, your husband, your dog, like it doesn't matter what they think because they're not your customer. People try to get validation from the wrong people. The market is your validator. Everything else doesn't matter. Like I remember my mom one time said, oh, you could be a rock star. I'm like, have you heard me sing? I mean, the dogs go running. This is a bad idea. I should not be. That is not what I'm here for. I'm meant to build things. And then when you go and you learn by building and flopping, and I mean, I've had 70 plus companies, and more than half of those things were lessons. They weren't losses. They were just lessons. Now I spent money and I didn't make money in those things. I learned something and I grew. And that's what enabled me to get to the point where I was ready to do Frame Tech and brought in $100 million to be able to build it, and had hundreds of investors and the A team. And that's because of all the other ones. At this point, the market cares about this big time. The poo-pooers, the people that are out there saying, well, no, this has been tried before and it's a bad idea, or you're really stretching. You've never done something like this. You've never gone and raised $250 million for manufacturing plants. You've done these little things for $5 or $10 million. I just ignore them. And I believe in myself. And that's where everybody has to get to. You have to be able to believe in yourself and really stop listening to other people that are going to tell you that it's crazy, or like, we need a little crazy. I mean, how does anything actually get built or created, or how do we have those epic, I mean, how do we get to space without Elon being a little crazy? You know, how do we have all the cool technology? How do we, anything that's the evolution of humanity requires somebody being crazy before they're a genius. And so we all have the genius inside us. We have to start with a little crazy to get to the genius.
Yeah, I like to call it a little delusion, but I think a little delusion is good in every entrepreneur and in anybody in general. I mean, as long as you have that like self-confidence to believe and kind of go through it with that, I mean, I 100% agree with that. But, you know, with your experience, if you're willing to share, I would love to hear like maybe one of the best lessons that you got from one of the business ventures that you had, and maybe something that you learned the most from.
You learn the most from the things that you get that basically punch you in the throat. And one of the biggest throat punching adventures, episodes, if you will, was 2008. And a lot of people had kind of pain, some type of experience. I ended up losing $25 million, was in the hole by millions, ended up being homeless, living out of my vehicle for a while in Northern Arizona, which is really cold in January, by the way. And the experience, really what it taught me was that when you lose money, you're not going to die. It doesn't eat you. When you make a mistake, when you do things that are at what I thought was a colossal level, it is relative to anything I'd done before, but the mistakes don't eat you. What will eat you is regret. And that's, I mean, I learned that 10 years ago, right before my dad died, and he sat there in front of me like 6 weeks before he passed away. And he said, you know, there are so many things that I wanted to do, and he knew he was out of time with his cancer. And that ate me, and it still does. It's that most people are walking down, tiptoeing safely to death's door, and they're doing it because they don't want to step into the potential where they go a little bit crazy or delusional. And that's where all the juice is. It's expanding and growing. Because if you're not expanding and growing, you're dying. Like, the universe doesn't do homeostasis where everything is flat. There's never flat. It's never just, people think, if I have enough money, I can just cruise. No, there's a reason that the average male in the United States dies within 30 months of retiring, because universe is done with you. If you're done contributing, then you become an eater, if you will, and you're just consuming resources. And that's not how this works. We've got to be creators. And that's what, that there's this like divine providence that happens when you have a vision and you go and you grind and you believe and you work on it. All sorts of amazing things start following you, and it's called tailwinds and things that you could have never dreamed up, but they show up. And I think that's the great power in having a vision and having a grind and a resiliency and a commitment to something, that magic happens. And most people don't ever get there because they're so freaking worried about what somebody's going to think about them. And that's their biggest focus, instead of what might I be able to do if I were to give everything I've got for that thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. I want you to make some predictions here for 2025 with Trump in office. Like, I want you to tell me how you think what the interest rate environment is going to look like at the end of next year, and how you think the markets in general are going to be looking. And then we'll dive into a little more personal questions here, so that the listeners at home can really get to know you, Damian. But I want you to call your shot like your Babe Ruth here and tell us some of the 2025 macro predictions you got for us.
I think you're going to have maybe another little dip potentially in December and the beginning of the year. I think that there's likely that we see another maybe 25 to 50 basis points. And I think you're going to see a slowing, because what's happening is we're not seeing a collapse. Now, eggs are getting more expensive, and there's a big concern about what happens if you make money cheaper. You're going to have more of that stuff. I think the government shrinking is going to do more to boom the economy without having to give us free money and just taking the regulations away, which I believe is going to happen in a significant way. So I think you're going to have some pretty hyper growth and a boomtown economy for the next couple of years. And I don't know that the interest rate environment is going to have a whole lot of impact there. My biggest concern with the interest rate being higher is you've got a lot of zombie banks, whether it's Bank of America or a ton of these banks that have these bonds that are underwater by tens and hundreds of billions of dollars. And they're not being forced to mark to market. They're not being forced to acknowledge the actual losses on the books. They're getting to carry them to term, which is not really how it should be. But you don't want to have Bank of America failing, because the potential ripple effect is pretty bad. So I think that's the kind of stuff there's a threat there. I don't think that the issue is going to be forced, because they're too big to fail like they were in 2008. They've actually gotten bigger. But there is a big problem that's sitting on these balance sheets. Can we grow out of it? Yeah, I think we can grow out of it. And I think that's fortunately we have the opportunity with this type of philosophy that less government is better. I think it's going to create a boom that's going to overshadow that kind of stuff, and we can work our way out of this thing. So I am definitely very optimistic about the next couple of years. And I think anybody that sits on the sidelines and waits is making a giant mistake.
I hear you on that. And I like to say, I think I'm optimistic going forward as well. So yeah, we'll see how 25 plays out. But yeah, Damian, I see you're wearing a University of Oregon hat. So I got to assume you're an Oregon fan. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's funny, because I went to the University of Portland. So I went to a school in Oregon for a year, and that school has a great soccer team, but there's no football anywhere near that school. So this is the closest thing I have to being on the winning team. And so I'm all sorts of duck this year.
Okay. So all right. So is your prediction for the college football playoff that the Oregon Ducks, led by Dylan Gabriel, are going to win the national championship?
I would love to see the Ducks and the Longhorns. I went to both schools, and I think it'd be really fun to see those guys playing. I think that it's possible. It's what's fun about college football is anything is possible. Like, anything can happen every week, and I'm actually kind of excited about this year. But I think Oregon could actually pull it off, which would be kind of fun.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't like that you said the University of Texas. I am here in Austin, but I'm an Aggie, and actually, my little sister's track uniform from A&M is here right behind me right now as we're recording this podcast. So I gotta say, saw them off, man, and I'm hoping that you know, my Aggies spoil some of their hopes here on Saturday. So we're recording this on the 25th. It's going to be coming out right after that game. So maybe everybody will be tweeting at me, laughing at some tears. But are you a big Nike guy? Have you been out to the track at Oregon? Because that's when I think of Oregon, that's what I think of is you know, Nike and their huge track tradition.
I think that'd be one of the cool places to go see. I haven't been there. I believe that would be an incredible experience. And it's, you know, every time you see something that's built that's beautiful like that, you can see human potential, like what's possible. And when you really go all in on creating something amazing and beautiful, I don't think most people, if you look at government buildings, a great example of the opposite of beautiful and robust, you just see what it's like killing the human spirit. So I think when you look at the Oregon campus and you see what they've built there, it's like to serve and juice the human spirit. It's very cool. I mean, the pictures you see, but to be there, I mean, it'd almost be worth just going to school there just to be in that environment.
Yeah, 100%. I definitely want to check out a track meet at Hayward Field. It's just so much history behind there. And yeah, the track program there is absolutely incredible. But you said, okay, so you've been to, you've lived in Oregon for a little bit. You've lived in Austin because you went to UT. Now, where's your favorite place in the U.S. here?
So I think that my favorite place, unfortunately, and I say that sort of like seriously, unfortunately, was on a beach in Solana Beach. I lived there in California a couple of times. And there's a very deep connection to nature. Now, I live in Sedona now, which is incredible. It's beautiful. And I'll always spend time here because it is, there's something different about being close to nature. When it's too much concrete, you're disconnecting from God. Like you're like, there's something just artificial about it. And so Solana, you're right there with the ocean. You see dolphins in your backyard. Here I get to, you know, I've got coyotes and deer and everything sitting in front of my window, just hanging out. And I think that's for me, that feeds my soul. And those are my favorite places. Jackson was like that, having moose walk up and literally being right in my face, or having buffalo running in front of me. So all these things, there's a reason that people flock to these places for the experience. I love living in them, and it's like every day is that experience to a certain degree. So I have a lot of different varieties. I'm not much of a big city guy. I like to go check out the cities and then leave because they tend to be too frenetic and too soul-sucking. So I like to go there and connect and get juiced with the energy and the enthusiasm, and then get the hell out and be back connected with natural beauty.
Well, then it sounds like you're a little bit of a camping guy, or maybe you like to be out in nature a little bit more. What's the craziest animal that you've seen either at a camping ground or even walk up to your door or something along those lines?
I mean, I've seen everything. I literally, when I was in Alaska, my last job up there, I was in the Arctic Circle, and I had polar bears outside that I had to avoid because they will eat you if they get close. And I was taking out the trash, and they would be there. And when I've been on safari in Africa, if you're stupid, you go out there and animals will just literally eat you. So that most people are worried about being eaten by their mistakes. But the reality is, unless you're in Alaska or Africa, you're probably not going to be eaten. I've bumped into everything, whether it's deer or elk or moose. I've been chased by moose in Alaska on snowmobiles. I've had bear in my front yard. Like, I used to walk to the school bus and I'd have moose just laying around, and you're kind of like walking around them. So you get to a point where that stuff becomes normalized, and it's like a television show that's your life. And I think it's incredibly cool to be part of that. And because there's animals and kids are totally honest. And so I always like being around honesty, and you never really totally know with adults. Am I getting the story here, or is this an agenda? And I just love, like, you're never going to have an agenda with a coyote or a javelina, which is like a giant rat pig. Like they're just doing them, and just being with that is a very cool, grounded experience that I think most of us miss because we're constantly dealing with our own agenda and other people's agendas. So to get out of that as much as possible, I think is a very healthy, grounding, peaceful experience that we should probably do more of.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I don't know. I'm a little bit of a city guy myself. I think the closest I've got to anything like that is maybe playing a video game like Cabela's Most Dangerous Hunts or something like that, where I get these giant animals running at you on the PlayStation. But I need to get out into nature more and experience some of that. I've been trying, man. I've been trying, but I'm not as bold in the wilderness as yourself there. But it sounds really exciting. How is the salmon, the fresh salmon in Alaska? You got to tell me it was the best thing you've ever tasted, right?
I'll tell you what, the real food is like a different level. Most people, unfortunately, haven't really experienced real food. One of the things I love about California is real produce. You go in there and you have farmers markets and you realize what a strawberry tastes like anywhere else. You're like, man, this strawberry, they're not supposed to be white, but they're literally white, you know, because they pull them and 2 weeks later you eat them. But like the salmon up in Alaska and real food, real meat. And that's another cool thing that I'm optimistic about with Kennedy and the work around our food system. If you can go have fresh fish, whether you're catching a fish in the Gulf on a fishing boat, or you have salmon in Alaska or halibut, these things are such a different experience. You're like, wow, there's actual flavors here. This is real, and versus factory farming and factory production. Unfortunately, I don't think most of us have any sense of what real food tastes like anymore. It's been over chemicalized and over processed. And I'm optimistic there is going to be some changes there where you can dig, you can really experience that. Unfortunately, I didn't really eat salmon when I was growing up. I eat processed cow and it was in a Saran wrap thing. So I missed out on that. Now I eat it all the time, but the closer you can get to the food and the real food, I think we're going to be healthier, happier, more clearer. And so, you know, now I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I definitely am optimistic of the future of the Make America Healthy Again. I think, you know, I definitely resonate with that. And I'm definitely looking forward to how Kennedy is going to flip that stuff on its head. But Damian, you've been very generous with your time. You've entertained me a little bit here with some of these questions. So I really appreciate you being a good sport with all that. Why don't you tell people where they can find you and what else you got going on?
You know, the best place to find me is if you go to turnkeyretirement.com, I wrote some books, like one of the, it's a downloadable book. It's called 10 Steps to 10 Million. And it's really the way that I see how you can go from wherever you are to $10 million in net worth within 10 years. And the reason that's important is because it really, like we were talking about earlier with your potential, if you'll stretch yourself, if you have a kind of framework to go towards your potential, the money takes care of itself. But you got to think big enough. If you're like, okay, I'm going to make $100,000 and that's my goal, you're going to tap into like 1% of your potential. And so this is the framework that I built. And if you have a playbook for a retirement, and all retirement does is it takes money out of the equation. It's not about stopping working or contributing or building. It's about getting to a place where money is no longer your God or the thing that you're worried about. And so if you can step into that and you have this turnkey system to $10 million, then you're going to build something and you're going to free yourself from the financial shackles that really is what money is today. And so that's what go visit turnkeyretirement.com and download that thing and engage. And I'd love to see everybody there.
100%. And I'll put all that in the show notes. And Damian, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate you.